A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
All right, Comedians of Law fans, this is Comedians of Law podcast episode 72, excuse me. I believe that's right. Is it 72, Ndidi?
72 sounds good. We'll go with that.
Okay, well, let's hope that's right. we believe it's episode 72. I'm going to actually check that. This is Alex Barnett, by the way, bungling the intro to the podcast already. And I'm joined in the booth. It is episode 72, and I'm joined by Ndidi Origi, a special
tag.
Hello, Ndidi. a special tag team coupling here. We've got some really cool stuff going on this week, and before we get into the news, we've got a couple of really interesting updates. First of all, this week, big, is Valentine's Day, and in honor of Valentine's Day, Ndidi is producing a comedy show called Comedy Diaspora that's out in Brooklyn. So, Ndidi, you want to give a quick 20-second plug to that?
Yes, sir. So, any of you who are living in Brooklyn or Manhattan or even in Connecticut, come on down. We're having a special Valentine's Day edition of Comedy Diaspora, which is going to feature a bunch of hilarious comics. And it's going to start around 7 o'clock at Jollof Restaurant in Brooklyn. You can just go on our Twitter at Comedy Diaspora and check us out. But our very own Alex will be on the show as well. So really looking forward to it.
Yeah, what's the address of the restaurant or the venue?
It's on Bedford Avenue, basically on the corner of Bedford and Putnam. For those who live in New York City, it's basically the A or the C train to Franklin. So.
And it's named Jollof?
Yes, J-O-L-L-O-F-F.
Okay, Brooklyn. So for those of you who are going out for Valentine's Day, is a good way to have some fun and have a nice date that isn't a fortune. You know, you don't get ripped off for Valentine's Day. And if you're single and looking for love, also a great place to go meet people because they'll be laughing, they'll be drinking, they'll be having a good time, and you can sneak in while they're not paying attention and, you know, couple up with them.
Exactly.
And then Saturday night, if you're in Manhattan, I'm producing a show along with some other dad comics called The Dads of Comedy at Gotham Comedy Club that's at 7 o'clock. At Gotham, which is 208 West 23rd Street, and you can hit us up or hit me up online or at Barnett Comic on Twitter for tickets. And then in the future, coming up for the Comedians of Law, we've got some really great stuff. We've got April 8th. We're going to be featuring at the Westchester Comedy Festival.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
That.
And then April 10th, a couple days later, we're going to be at Levity Live, the premier flagship comedy club in Nyack, New York. And that's very exciting.
Yeah.
And we've got a couple of private events on the horizon as well. I'm going to be out in Cleveland. There's a thing in the city we're doing. And law schools out there, if you're interested in having us come perform, definitely hit us up on Twitter at Comedians at Law or on the web. You can email us at info@comediansatlaw.com. All right. Anything else, Ndidi, that we have to announce right now?
I think that's it for now.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Well, let's get right into the news.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
All right, this week we have some really interesting news stories. And you actually unearthed these, so I props to you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. The first one, I think, is important to all people, but particularly to women, because from my experience with my wife, women are the ones who really do the primary shopping at the drugstores of the world.
Right.
And this news story is about what unhealthy products should CVS, the drugstore, stop selling. And so I'm going to throw it open to you. As a woman who's a married person, what products are you concerned about them selling and that you want them to stop selling?
Well, I think first it would be good for our audience to know that some of the folks who, some of the the article that we're talking about was in the New York Times, and it had to do with the fact that CVS said recently that they're going to be no longer going to be selling cigarettes. And the whole reasoning behind it is that it's something that they consider to be in contradiction with their mission of becoming more like a healthcare company and less of just a, you know, a drugstore. And so the question of sort of what else did we think that CVS should stop selling, I really jumped to the unhealthy foods because I felt like, you know, if they're going to start down that road, then they might as well get rid of soda and get rid of, you know, junk food. But I also think it's a little interesting to think about their method of sort of going about getting to their goal of helping people be healthier. Because while I understand them not selling cigarettes, I know that they sell things that can be just as bad for you when consumed in large quantities, like potato chips, for example, or drinking a bunch of soda. And I just wonder, it's a slippery slope. You know, when does it stop? When can they say, okay, you know, we've taken away everything that could possibly be harmful to somebody? And I'm not a smoker, but I understand the arguments that sometimes smokers make of, well, you know, we should be able to kind of choose for ourselves.
Okay, so let me interject just there. So, all right, you're talking about smoking, which obviously has been proven to be very bad for people. But what about other products that are not necessarily bad for people, at least directly, but are bad for the world or the globe or the environment, such as nylon or polyester containing products, or toilet paper that's been made from trees, or batteries that get thrown away and then degrade into the ground and poison the groundwater with mercury? I mean, so my question to you is, you asked the question, slippery slope, where does it end? So I'm furthering that, where does it end?
Well, I think it ends where it runs into their business imperative. And really, it's when you start talking about what's the motivation for this. And I think in the article, the CEO was pretty clear that they're doing this not just because they think it's, you know, morally or some sort of good that they need to put out into the world, but really that it has to do with where they see themselves as a company in the future. And I can see a situation where if they need to position themselves in a different way, they could sort of rescind this. Or if they decide they're going to be positioning themselves as, you know, let's say an environmental leader, and they felt that that was what was really going to push the business forward, then they could just as easily stop selling some of the things that you mentioned that are not good for the environment.
Okay, so, all right, that's a very, you know, management 101 answer. Let's get down to brass tacks. You're a consumer. You're a married person. You live in New York City. You have issues about different things. What would you ban? What would you stop selling if you were in charge of CVS?
I would stop selling. You know, what I would do is stop with the displays in the front that have all the delicious candies and other things that distract you, or things that you would never buy, except that they're right there in front of you. You know, sometimes they'll have those energy bars and things like that that I would never ever purchase, but just because it's right there and I'm standing in line, I start looking at it like, maybe I need to get one of these to get me through the rest of the day. So if I was an owner of a CVS, I would move all those displays from the front. But then my business probably wouldn't make as much money as it could.
Okay.
What about you? What would you ban?
All right, I'm going to get to me in a second, but what about hair care products? Like I look at the local drugstores in my neighborhood. There's tons of ladies' hair care products. A lot of them are like straighteners and relaxers and whatnot. Clearly bad for your hair, probably bad for your scalp. What about those? Are they still good to sell that stuff that's terrible for people's bodies and skin?
Yeah, I feel like people have to be able to choose for themselves. You know, I feel like that was going back to my original comment, is I just don't think that you can really completely control people's behavior. I totally understand making certain things more difficult for people to get to, especially things like cigarettes that can get kids when they're young, for example, and then they're addicted to it for the rest of their lives. But when it comes to things like, you know, hair products and even what I mentioned before about junk food and sodas and things like that, I just think that you have to draw a line somewhere. And ultimately, it's a business, right? They're not a not-for-profit. They're not a non-governmental organization. They're there to make money, and all the things they're going to do have to do with making themselves more money.
Okay. All right. All right. So that's very capitalistic of you. Me personally, I would ban toilet paper that's too thin. That's like the key thing that the drugstore sells several things that are critical, right? Toothpaste, soap, toothbrushes, floss, and toilet paper. Like, that's their staple stuff. That's their strike zone. To me, with toilet paper, you know, I don't necessarily need it to be as thick as a bath towel, but, you know, it should be, you know, reasonable. And the stuff that they pass off as being environmental or whatever, it's always just an excuse to sell toilet paper that's, you know, thinner than a tissue, and that's ridiculous. So that's what I would ban. All right.
That sounds good.
Yeah. So with that, let's move on to the next story, which has been big in the news this week. This is involving Mia Farrow, Woody Allen, and Dylan Farrow in particular. Dylan, which is Mia Farrow's daughter. I guess, is it her adopted daughter?
Yes.
And there's been accusations, particularly by Dylan Farrow herself, that Woody Allen sexually molested her when she was a child. This is a hot-button issue, naturally. Involves celebrity, involves sexual molestation of a child, which is detestable. Generally, it's detestable. And if true, in this case, it's detestable. What's going on here? What do you think about this? I mean, do we think Woody Allen is actually a child molester?
You know, before we get into that, I do want to say that just in case someone's been living under a rock and hasn't read anything about this at all, that this all stems from Woody Allen and Mia Farrow's pretty acrimonious custody battle back in the early 90s. And a lot of this has, over the years, sort of been talked about, and it bubbles up sometimes, especially in light of Woody Allen's continuing marriage to his ex-girlfriend's adopted daughter, Soon-Yi Previn. And so that's kind of the environment that all of this is going on in. And for me, when I was reading about the story, I felt like, you know, it's so difficult for me, because my initial thing is, my heart goes out to the woman, Dylan Farrow, who remembers this, and if you read any of the articles that have been written about it, you know, she feels this very deeply, and she's saying this story for the first time, and it's obvious from her words that this is something that really affected her childhood and affected her adulthood. And when you read Woody Allen's response, which he gave a response to the New York Times this weekend, you don't get the same sense of, you know, feeling for him, because he takes on a very sort of accusatory and defensive stance against his ex-girlfriend, Mia Farrow, and says, you know, mostly focuses on the fact that she's an evil person who put this into his adopted daughter's head. But ultimately, for me, as somebody who's not involved in any of this and is just an outsider, is really, you know, what's the protocol when someone was never convicted for something but is a public person and a powerful person? And with somebody who has as much power as him, what is it that you do to sort of balance out the story and the image? Because in one of the things that Dylan Farrow talks about is the fact that all of the different people who continue to work with him, all of the, you know, he got a Golden Globe Award, an Achievement Award. He's been nominated for an Oscar. I mean, he's been nominated for many Oscars over the years, but he was nominated for one for this year. And how each of those used to feel like a slap in the face to her and to other people who were victims of sexual abuse.
Okay.
So for me, it's just, what is the protocol when someone was never convicted, you know, but they are a public person, they're a powerful person.
Right. Well, isn't the answer the same regardless? I mean, I understand the point you're making, but I guess isn't the protocol or the response the same for Woody Allen or for John Doe, which is, look, in our system of law and the courts, you're innocent until proven guilty, right? And so in this instance, if there's evidence or proof that Woody Allen, you know, engaged in molestation of his girlfriend's adoptive daughter, a child at the time, a minor, and there's a trial and he's proven guilty, well, that's the way. But, you know, then he should be treated accordingly. But if there's no evidence, you know, is it appropriate for people to dismiss him or treat him otherwise than they do now simply because of accusations made by one person? Because otherwise, you know, because doesn't that lead to just the whole system falling apart? I mean, anyone can accuse anyone of anything.
Well, that's the issue, because there's never been agreement over the years, because if, you know, reading some older information about it, there was a recent Vanity Fair article that kind of talked about all of the details of the initial case, is that, you know, there was a judge who disagreed with the way that the investigation was conducted and felt that, you know, something had happened with him, with Woody Allen, that he had acted inappropriately towards his daughter, and wrote an opinion, you know, saying that. And then there was an investigation by what, you know, was reported to be a third party investigative unit, and, you know, they found that nothing, there was no evidence that there was abuse. And then there was also, you know, it's that thing where there were conflicting accounts. You know, there was the police found that there was enough evidence to pursue a criminal case, but because of the age of the victim and the fragile, you know, nature of the young victim, they didn't want to pursue any criminal case. So it would be great if there was a clear yes or no answer.
Right.
Clear evidence, but there just isn't. And so when you're faced with that, as somebody, again, who is not personally touched by it, but is sort of, you know, outside, and you know, one thing I did want to kind of talk about and ask you what you think, really about what people have been doing, because, you know, no matter what you kind of think of his personal life and how he leads it, there is one thing that I feel that people are doing right now that I want to get your thoughts on, which is that they're really looking at his art for, you know, quote-unquote clues, and, you know, assigning certain things they see in his art, like his, and I haven't seen any Woody Allen movies, so I'm not a Woody Allen expert by any means.
Right.
But in his film Manhattan, where he, you know, depicts the relationship of, you know, a 40-something-year-old man with a high school student, and Meryl Hemingway is in the movie, I believe, and she was actually 16 at the time that she was filming this, and he was actually in his 40s.
Right.
And people are looking back at things like that and saying, you know, look, this guy, look at the types of things he puts in his film.
Well, right, and also in his real life. I mean, look, he's married to the daughter of his former girlfriend, and he knew this girl when she was a girl, when a minor.
Right.
So, I mean, look, there's a lot
So what do you think, though, about people looking at someone's art for clues as to how that person does or does not behave?
You know, I think you gotta really be careful about doing that, because sure, like, every artist puts some piece of their life or their psychology into their art, right? People write about and paint and write music about or perform what they know, what comes from within. At the same time, you know, we're not, the general populace is not a bunch of psychologists. You don't know how much an artist filters whatever they're thinking or starts at point A, which is a true point, and then expands on that in a creative way. So I think it would be a tremendous disservice to start sort of unpacking his art to figure out, well, that was really true. I mean, it might have been wish fulfillment in some respects. It might have been just this was an interesting idea to him because he thought he was surrounded by young, good-looking women, and he was thinking, well, what would happen if So, you know, I think you can't do it, because that's just a slippery slope. Because the next thing is, you know, then you have a fascist state where people are being prosecuted for their art.
Well, it's funny you would say that, because when I was thinking about that particular aspect of it, I started thinking back to the story that was in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago in mid-January about how the police are using rap lyrics and they're presenting it as evidence in criminal cases. And this is something that has been going on, and it was coming up for the Supreme Court in New Jersey as to whether this is something that they were going to allow to continue happening. And I really felt the same way that you do, is that, you know, it's a very dangerous thing to sort of start going into, although I can see why people do it, it's a very dangerous thing to start looking at someone's art and then extrapolating, you know, something into the real world that can affect someone's life based on what they put into their art, whether or not you agree with that art or how they live their life.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I'm in agreement with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, so I think that's a dead end. Unless someone's, for example, rapping about how they killed a cop, and it leaves a trail of breadcrumbs to an actual killing.
Right. And in this case that they were discussing, there was none of that. This
right.
was just someone who was writing, you know, lyrics from you know, years before that had no details of any crime in it, and then they were just sort of using it to say, oh, look, you know, a person like this, you can tell that he's a
sure.
violent person.
Sure.
But, you know, one thing I do have to say, the only, if you want to say good, that comes out of this, because it's very sad to kind of see, you know, a family that clearly this has been affecting their
lives. Well,
they're
messed up because look at the brother, right? The brother is supposedly, the son of supposedly Woody Allen and Mia Farrow looks just like Frank Sinatra. So this family's got all kinds of issues.
There's all sorts of other things
going on. He's married to the daughter or the adoptive daughter. The kid was definitely, you know, or not definitely, but Frank Sinatra seems like it was his father. Now there's this issue about whether Alan molested the adoptive daughter, his girlfriend. I mean, the whole family seems like they're all kind of bent out of whack there. But
yeah,
anyway, finish your point and then we'll move on. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the one good thing that comes out of this is that I feel like at least it's bringing these issues to the forefront, and it's not an issue that most people are comfortable talking about, but it's a very, very real issue, and it does happen to people who are not, you know, famous celebrities. And it's good that at least this type of discussion is happening in the wider culture, because as we all know, once people kind of see things, you know, being discussed by celebrities, and they feel more comfortable discussing it in their own lives. So hopefully, if anything good can come out of that, you know, then that's the best thing.
Yeah. Well, that was a really funny story. Thanks for that.
Yeah, that was hilarious. It's what
don't
you know,
forget we're comedians at law. We're not like lawyers at law here in the media. All right. So let's pick a third story that's at least. Perhaps has an amusing part. Of course, I say that, and now we're about to talk about
yeah,
someone dying.
This has been a very
so the third story
death,
that Aditi in her infinite wisdom has chosen for us to talk about in this comedic podcast.
Can I just pause before you say that? Can I just pause and say how this started very differently? First, you were giving me credit for picking these great stories, and as we're going through them, it became Aditi in her infinite knowledge.
They're bringing us down here. But anyway, so the third story, you know, look, sadly, tragically, Philip Seymour Hoffman died very, very recently from a heroin overdose. Apparently, from all the news accounts, he was a very well-liked and gifted guy who was very troubled and really struggled with addiction his entire adult life, if not longer. And his funeral was just recently held in New York City, I believe, or New York, certainly. And the wrinkle to this story is that apparently when celebrities who knew him showed up for the funeral to pay their respects, a PR company, or Valentino, which is a fashion house, tweeted out about the swag that of theirs that celebrities were carrying or wearing.
Right.
And this caused a shockwave through the Twitterverse, because people were like, oh my God, do you have any morals or scruples or taste or good sense in your bodies to do this at a time of a funeral? What do you think here? I mean, is sacred?
For me, it's just, you know, we've gotten to the point now where we just really believe that everything is a product placement. What was most interesting to me is that not only did the celebrity was Amy Adams, and she was carrying a Valentino purse, and when the initial PR blast went out, it said, you know, Amy Adams captured in New York carrying, you know, this purse. And they didn't mention where she was carrying it to, which was to a wake, to a funeral. And for me, the most interesting part of it was that Valentino had to apologize, and they had to clearly note that Amy Adams had nothing to do with them and was not involved in this PR mess at all. And then on top of that, Amy Adams' publicist had to also come out and say the thought that, you know, anyone would think that she had anything to do with this, you know, sort of carrying the purse as a way of getting attention for Valentino is just, you know, appalling.
So do you think that she protests too much? Do you think she actually set it up?
No. I don't think she had anything to do with that. I mean, I think for someone, you know, she's doing great right now. She was just an American Hustle. She's been nominated for all sorts of awards. I don't think she needs to carry a Valentino purse and agree to something like this. That would not be good for her image. So I believe her. I just think it's so funny that now we're at the point where, you know, both Valentino and her publicist had to speak out to make it clear, because that is the conclusion that we jump to now. We're so used to, you know, we're cynical about it. We're so used to product placement, you know, just being everywhere, that when, you know, something like this happened, we just think, oh, that's product placement. That
right.
Was terribly
well, let
wrong.
Me ask you this. Do you think that if putting on your Machiavellian hat, do you think that they did that, and notwithstanding their protestations to the contrary, they actually did it on purpose to get the bad press so that they could then come out and apologize and get attention, which would draw more attention to them and to their handbags and accessories and so forth.
You know, I would if it were a sort of lesser fashion house, but I think Valentino's pretty luxury. I mean, I think that purse was $2,500 or something. They're not really in the business of trying to get the word out, you know, for us common folk. I think it's really more of trying to spot these celebrities in these high fashion, environments, carrying their purses and their accessories and their clothes, wearing their clothes. So I just don't see how it would be beneficial to them, because this is not the type of talk I think that they would like or would have envisioned.
You think it was if someone less classy would have to be involved in this then, like the Kardashians, like Kim Kardashian would have to be.
Yeah, some sort of Kardashian involvement would have made me think differently. You know, one of the things that was someone in the LA Times was writing, they suggested, you know, perhaps celebrities should not be wearing anything that ostentatious and expensive at a funeral or other, you know, similarly somber situations if they don't want that kind of attention. But to me, that seemed a little bit disingenuous, because that's what they do. You know, if Amy Adams was at the funeral, you know, without makeup on, without carrying something fancy and looking her absolute best, that she would be all over the cover of every, you know, tabloid magazine.
Well, right.
In the thing, saying, how could she go to Philip Seymour Hoffman's funeral looking like such a mess, you know? So I think it's a little bit disingenuous for them to say, oh, you should just wear things that have no labels on them.
Okay, so here's the question for you. Since we're technically a law podcast, where's the law angle to this whole thing? Can we sue Valentino for lack of class and character?
I think we would win that suit in the court of public opinion.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. Let's move over to the before we move to the Twitter feed, let's go to our interview for the week. We have a great interview this week. I interviewed a fellow named Colin Clarity, fascinating guy, really nice guy. He is a former NFL football player, tight end, who now has chosen to pursue a career in law. He's a 1L now at University of Maryland Law School. Here's the interview. At Law Fans, we have a very special interview for you today. This is Alex Barnett manning the microphone. I'm joined by my junior interviewer, my son Ivan, who's 2.5, and insisted on being on this interview because our guest today is Colin Clarity, a NFL football player who's now decided to hang up his spikes and become a lawyer. Welcome to the podcast, Colin.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I will tell you, you're in a proud tradition of celebrity interviewees. We had Lee Steinberg some months ago, who you may remember was an agent for football players. So you're our second NFL type, although first player, so we're really proud to have you on. And let's just give a quick background. I know I did some research about you. I know you went to Brown University, is that right?
Yeah.
That's right. So you're not only a great football player, but smart, which is probably a rarity amongst NFLers. Or I shouldn't say that, I'm going to get beaten up. But tell us, where are you from originally?
I'm from Bethesda, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And I grew up in Maryland, went to high school at a place called Gonzaga, which is in downtown D.C., a couple blocks from the U.S. Capitol building, and then went up to Brown for college.
Okay, now Gonzaga, I spent some time in D.C. Gonzaga is known as a sports school, correct?
Yeah, I was in Montgomery County Public Schools, and I was going to go to a school that had not won a football game, I think, in 2 years. And I decided that I wanted to play sports, and Gonzaga, a lot of kids in my area went to Gonzaga. So I went down there, shadowed for a day, and loved it, and ended up going there.
That's great. That's great. So you went from Gonzaga, and I'm sure we're a standout athlete there, to Brown, which is an interesting choice because Brown's obviously a great school, but not necessarily known for its athletics. So what was the thought process there?
Well, I really wanted to get a scholarship for football coming out of Gonzaga. I had a couple scholarship offers, but then Penn and Brown started talking to me during the recruiting season. And once they started talking to me, my parents basically were like, you can go to Brown or Penn or whatever other Ivy League you want, but you're going to an Ivy League school kind of thing. Which as a 17-year-old, I thought was completely ridiculous because they hadn't read that JMU had 7-3 girl-to-guy ratio.
Right.
But I ended up going to Brown. There's a great great place to spend 4 years. I loved it. I, you know, couldn't have been happier. And even after paying back all the student loans, I still will go back. So,
well, so just for disclosure purposes, I went to Penn, and in the much before you. I mean, I graduated in '89. So I'm considerably older, but I do remember Penn had a pretty good football team in those days.
Penn has a great football team, and my girlfriend actually went to Penn, and she played lacrosse there, so we have a good Ivy League kind of, you know, trash talking going on.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to put pressure on you guys, but if in fact you guys get married and have kids, that should be a good pedigree for some Ivy League athletic children, maybe in the Penn Relays or rowing or one of the crew teams. So Browns football, how were they at the time when you were there? I mean, how was the team stacking up?
We were good. We won two Ivy League championships when I was there, my freshman year and my senior year.
So you won a couple of championships at Brown playing football. Yep. And then now, how does it work when you're trying to get to the pros from an Ivy League school, which is not necessarily a football powerhouse? Do you become a walk-on? Do you become a free agent? How does that work?
Yeah, I was a free agent, so I trained. They have like a combine in Indianapolis where they have all the big, you know, the top stud athletes go. I wasn't invited to that, so I did a couple pro days. I snuck into BC and Harvard's pro day because they had more, you know, higher stake recruit than I had at Brown. I also did the Brown pro day, and I got kicked out of BC, and I was basically like, you know, I don't care if I get kicked out as long as someone notices me while I'm there, kind of attitude.
Right. Well, good for you for doing
that. So I ended up getting kicked out, but not until after I was able to, you know, run a 40 and do some of the drills they put you through. So I ended up getting picked up. I got a tryout offer from the Washington Redskins, which is the team I loved growing up. But they had drafted a guy at my position, and I got a call from the Colts, and they had a scout there called me up and said, how would you like to catch passes from Peyton Manning? And I said, I'd love to. Where do I sign?
Right. So just for the fans, just listening to this, you play tight end. Is that right?
Yeah, I play tight end, and I backed up Dallas Clark. So if you guys are familiar, if anyone out there is familiar with Dallas Clark or with the Colts for the past, you know, 10 years before the big change there, I was kind of more of a receiving tight end.
Right. Now, when you got kicked out of the BC Pro Day, would that require any legal enforcement? Like, do you have a record that you know, your potential lawyer employer should not know about?
No, I don't think so. They just kindly asked me to leave.
Okay. All right. So you went off to, so I guess you take it, you went off to Indianapolis?
Yeah, I went off. So I had, the draft happened. So I got picked up by Indianapolis about 30 minutes after the draft finished. So 3 days later, I was on a 4 days later, I was on a plane out to Indianapolis. So I went out there and did rookie mini camp and worked out there for a week or two, then went back to Brown and took my final exams, and then went back out right after my finals to go to more practices, and then went back to Providence to graduate. It was kind of like a crazy month, just shuttling back and forth and
right.
being tired the whole time. But it was pretty crazy.
Did you ultimately get signed by the Colts?
Yeah, so I made the practice squad. So it's kind of like the taxi team. You don't play in games, but you practice all week. You learn the offense. You're there, and it's a week to week contract. So I was basically, you know, however well I did that week, they could cut me or bring me back for the next week. So I was there for the first couple weeks of the season. I got cut because someone else got hurt, and they needed a space on the roster.
Okay.
So then I went from there. I was home for a couple weeks, went to the Cleveland Browns, was on the Cleveland Browns for a couple weeks, and I got cut from the Browns when we were 0-8, and then I got picked up back by the Colts. So I was driving home from Cleveland and hung a right on I-70 instead of going back to Maryland and drove out to Indianapolis and practiced the next day with the Colts.
Wow.
And we ended up going. I got activated and played in the last game of the year. I'm not sure if anybody is a big Colts fan, but we were 14-0 going in the last couple games of the season, and we decided to rest the stars for the playoffs. And everyone was really upset because they wanted us to try to go for undefeated.
Right.
Well, that's when I got in the game to play, so that was kind of fun for me. But I played in the last game, and we ended up going to the Super Bowl, which we lost to the Saints. But, yeah, that was my first year in the NFL. It was kind of a whirlwind from Brown. No one really, you know, cared to draft me or thought I was anything other than the Colts, and wound up in the Super Bowl losing to the Saints.
So with all the practice squad and the back and forth and then getting back on the Colts and going onto the active squad. What happened with the contract ultimately? Did you have a full contract? Did you have an agent that you had to utilize to do all this?
Yeah, I had an agent, and a guy named Brooks Henderson out of Massachusetts. And every NFL, no NFL contract is guaranteed except the big money guys. So I'm sure Peyton Manning and, you know, Aaron Rodgers and Drew Brees have big time, you know, guaranteed money. But for guys like me, they give you a contract and you happily sign it and, you know, start playing. So every time that I got cut, they would just rip up the contract and there's no guaranteed money. So I thought it was funny. The Brown newspaper said I was going to make $1 million in my first year. I was well short of $1 million.
So,
but then I went back to Brown and visited, and everyone thought, you know, I was making Peyton Manning money, which unfortunately was not true.
Right. So after that whirlwind year where you went to the Super Bowl, ultimately, what was the next step in the football career?
So I was in Indianapolis for the next offseason and training camp. I was injured way from the Colts. I had a problem with getting stingers in my neck. So I got waived right at the end of preseason and was home for a couple weeks. And then after I got healthy again, I got picked up by San Francisco and went out to San Francisco for what was Mike Singletary's last season. I was on the 49ers and was on the practice squad there until the last couple weeks, where I got moved up and played in the last couple games. That was my second season in the NFL.
Right. So ultimately, how many seasons did you have in the league?
I played in four seasons and five training camps.
Okay. And the final one you wrapped up with, you said, with the Falcons. Is that correct?
Yeah. I was playing for the Falcons most recently.
Right. And then you should tell the listeners the story about how you then – well, let me ask you this. You're just as a spoiler for people, Colin is now in law school. He's a 1L, and you're University of Maryland, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So at what point did you decide, I want to be a lawyer, whether right then or at some point in your life? I mean, when did that kind of occur to you?
The first time I thought about it was when I was in high school. I was robbed at gunpoint in downtown D.C.
Oh, me too.
I guess it doesn't speak too highly for D.C., but, you know, obviously they never caught the guy, and, you know, I was fine. There was no injuries or anything. But, you know, when you're 16 years old and think you're, you know, the toughest guy on the block as a football player, and it all goes away pretty quickly. I got pretty upset. You know, I was got righteous and thought, you know, I'd suffered the worst thing that ever happened to anybody. And I was like, man, this is wrong. You know, someone should stop these people from doing it. So I started thinking about, you know, being a prosecutor or something along those lines to try to catch the criminals who are doing that. So I would say that's the first time I thought about it. And then later on down the line, it was kind of always in the back of my mind. I was a history political science major in college. So I wouldn't say I was too far off of the pre-law track. But what was kind of interesting was after my second season in the 49ers, which I told you about earlier, the NFL had a lockout and there was a, you know, collective bargaining agreement. So the NFL ended up decertifying as a union. I was part of the NFL union. We decertified so that we could sue the owners. And the kind of cool part about that was that I got all these legal memos and we had conference calls about what was going on. And I thought this was like really, really interesting everything that was going on. And it was tons of money that we were fighting over. And I didn't really understand any of the legal stuff that was happening, but I was actually reading, you know, through these memos that they were sending us. And then I realized I was the only person on these conference calls and the only person reading these memos on my entire team. And I was like, you know what, maybe I should go to law school if I'm the only one actually interested in any of this.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So, all right. So now for people who are listening, Colin was on the Falcons, regrettably for your football career, you were cut, but you decided at that point you were going to go ahead and go to law school. You'd already, I guess, applied and gotten in.
Yeah. So the previous season I was on the Jaguars after I got cut from the 49ers the next year, I got picked up by the Jaguars, played there for my third season in the NFL. I actually scored a touchdown, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Cool.
And then, the next preseason I got cut and I got picked right back up by the Jaguars, played a game and then got cut again by the Jaguars. And then I didn't get picked up for the rest of the season. So I only played in week one. Well, I got pretty bored just sitting around doing nothing. I decided that, you know, I better have a backup plan if the NFL was over. So I took the LSAT, studied and took the LSAT, applied to a bunch of schools, and got into Maryland. Decided I was going to go there, put down my deposit, and the next day I got a call from the Falcons. So I was like, you know, a little, you know, I was really excited to go to Maryland Law, and then the Falcons called, and I was like, oh my gosh, here we go again.
So now you're in law school, and you're, I guess, what, 7 months in or so, I guess, one semester plus a little bit.
Yeah.
And how is it treating you? How do you feel about it? Is it as interesting as the NFL? Is it more interesting, less interesting?
I mean, it's really interesting. It's really different. I think that, you know, that would be kind of obvious to everybody, but I kind of like how it's competitive. I'm one of the people who was kind of excited about there being a curve, which I think is, I don't know, one of the more rare of 1Ls, because, you know, kind of got my competitive juices flowing. But it's a lot less stressful than the NFL, which I certainly enjoy. If I have a bad week, I don't have to get out of my lease, lose my health insurance, and head across the country back and move in with my mom and dad's.
Right.
So,
well, that's an interesting point. I think a lot of people, you know, either in law school or not even in law school or contemplating, think law school is incredibly stressful, which it can be. But here you are from your own perspective saying, you know, frankly, it's a lot less stressful than the existence I used to have, which is an interesting perspective.
Yeah. And I, you know, law school is as stressful as you want to make it. If you kind of have a good time with it and try to enjoy it for what it is, it's going to be a lot of reading. But, you know, I feel like sometimes people complain about reading. It's like a doctor complaining about blood. If you didn't know there was going to be reading, you might be.
So at this point, do you have a job lined up for the summer, a legal job?
Yeah, I'm going to intern for Judge Richard Leon in D.C. He's a federal judge.
Oh, that's nice. That's a good job. And are you
– Yeah, I'm excited about it.
I assume at this point a lot of your classmates are probably asking about your football career, because I recall – this is not exactly the perfect analogy, but I went to law school at St. John's in New York, and there was a guy there who played on the basketball team in the undergrad. And at the time when St. John's used to be relatively decent, although I think maybe they're coming and making a comeback now.
Yeah.
And, you know, almost on a daily basis, he would get asked for stories about the coach and about the team and what it was like to play at Madison Square Garden and so forth and so on. So I'm assuming that, like, almost on a daily basis, people must ask you about, the, you know, playing football and what your thought about the Super Bowl and Is that accurate or not?
Yeah, definitely. I have a lot of conversations about football, which I enjoy having, as long as it's I've gotten a couple of ones just people asking me how much money I made when I was there, which is kind of annoying. But other than that, it's been, you know, I was always a fan of football growing up. I was always watching it, you know, watching or playing for my entire life. So it's nice to be able to kind of, you know, talk about it and have people who are interested in, you know, I guess hearing my opinion for whatever it's worth. But, it's kind of like anything else. If you do it for long enough, you're going to love it and have an opinion on it. So, you know, I enjoy talking about it and, you know, just how, you know, figuring out how wrong I could be that Denver is going to win.
So let's conclude. What's your current view of, like, what you're thinking you're going to do in terms of your own legal career? Are you going to go into, like, being a sports agent? Do you want to be on the law enforcement side, the prosecution side?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I guess is the answer. I kind of have two ideas. One is to be a prosecutor. One is to try to get into some sports law, the sports law kind of practice area. But I'm not really too interested in being an agent, kind of, you know, exploring the other sports law aspects. But right now I'm a little bit more focused on trying to be a prosecutor, which is way, way back what I originally wanted to, you know, do. So I feel like it could change very quickly, because I feel like every day I'm learning how much I don't know about the law and what I'm studying.
Right.
But I'm sure that's a pretty normal thing when you're a lowly 1L.
Right.
But I don't know. I'm kind of excited to get in the court and kind of see what it's like this summer. And I don't know, just get a better idea with, you know, what being in court every day is actually like.
Very cool. Well, let's wrap this up. I want to give you an opportunity to plug anything you're involved in doing, whether it's a thing of your own, a charity, a extracurricular activity that you're proud of, anything like that. If you want to plug it, here's the time to do it.
I really don't have anything going on. I used to do a lot of charity stuff and talk to kids when I was in the NFL, but ever since I got to law school, I've kind of just been – been chilling and being selfish, I guess. So.
All right. Well, let's put some good karma out there for a year and a half, 2 years down the road when you're graduating. For the people listening, if you want to hire a guy who's a lawyer who used to be in the NFL, Colin Clardy is your man. And with that, we're going to wrap up. So everybody, we want to thank Colin for joining us in the booth today. And we'll go back to the podcast now. Okay, that was a great interview with Colin. We wish him really well. We hope to have him back on the podcast as a guest. Okay, and Didi, let's conclude the podcast, wrap it up this week with our look at the Twitter feed, which you've been kind of running, for lack of a better term. And I noticed that we're jumping up by leaps and bounds in number of followers. Not a lot of people tweeting at us, but a lot of people following us. So let's give a shout out to some of them that followed us this week.
Yeah, so we are really excited. We had a bunch of new followers. We got some of these wonderful folks whose names I love. My favorite name, I have to say, is Ibrahim Batambuze, because I myself know what it's like to have names of people mispronounced. So I hope that I got that right, Ibrahim. We also had Malenge Simaleni, who's also one of our followers, at King Simalin, and Play Shorts, which I thought was a great one. I also want to shout out Law Limbs, as well as Legally Bitching. That's also a nice one. And my favorite is that we got one of our, I believe she called herself a super fan, Ruth Carter, and she tweeted us, "Thanks for the love at Comedians at Law. Happy to be a super fan." And we're happy to have her as a super fan. We also got a couple other folks who, Kathleen Cruz, who retweeted us, and Felice favorited our tweet. And these are all great, guys, but we also want you to feel free to tweet at us, especially about all of the hilarious topics that we had this week, like cigarettes and family strife and, you know, carrying designer purses to funerals.
Right. And in fact, if I could interject, what we need, we need to throw down the gauntlet here a little bit, Ndidi. We need to have people engaging with us at a very serious level. So for next week, we want to challenge them to tweet at us. And by the way, know, listeners, that Ndidi is the one who is at the control panel of the Twitter feed for the Comedians at Law. So next week, we want you to tweet at Ndidi, particularly with a challenge. Challenge her legal knowledge. Come to the show on Friday the 14th at Jalafa and, you know, heckle her. Do something, but tweet a heckle at her. Tweet her a joke that she can use on stage.
Yes,
do something.
Please. I need your help.
Ask her a difficult question about the Nigerian law school. Whatever it is you want to do or hear from Ndidi, that's the challenge for next week's Twitter. Okay?
That sounds good.
I want people to challenge you. Your knowledge of intellectual property law, something. All right, is that you accept that challenge?
I do. Of course.
I like that. I like that you're stepping up to the plate on that one. Okay, well let's wrap this episode up. It's been a great episode with some really depressing stories, but interesting ones nonetheless. A great interview and a couple of shows coming up on the near-term horizon that people should definitely come to. So for the Comedians of Law, episode 72 of the podcast, this is Alex Barnett.
And I'm Ndidi Origi.
And we will talk to you soon.